Here's the WHUS weekend public affairs schedule. Saturdays at 4 p.m., it's Latino USA, alternating once a month with DIY Portland. At 4:30, it's the Shortwave Report, featuring shortwave radio broadcasts from all over the world. Then at 5 o'clock, we kick off 2 hours of Connecticut-produced shows with Jackie Arsenuk and the F-Files, dealing with today's issues from a feminist perspective. At 5:30, it's Change Surfer Radio with Jay Hughes, followed at 6 o'clock by Dean Farrell and an hour of Naked Lunch Radio. Finally, Saturday night, going into Sunday morning, from midnight to 1 a.m., we feature the subgenius Hour of Slack. And that's your weekend public affairs lineup on UConn's Radio for the People, 91.7 WHUS Stores.
Say you want a revolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. You tell me that it's evolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. But when you talk about destruction, that you can count me out.
Good evening to you, and welcome to Naked Lunch Radio here at WHUS. This is Dean Farrell, with a cold, by the way. If my voice sounds any different this week, that's why. And I'll be with you for the next hour, or until I lose my voice, whichever comes first. Gonna start off this week the way I've been starting the show for about the past month, with the atheist prayer. Our logic, which art in our heads, hallowed be thy wisdom. Thy enlightenment come, thy reasoned will be done, on earth as it actually is. Give us this day our daily needs, and guard us from our fallacies, as we correct those who indoctrinate their children. And lead us not into delusion, but deliver us from ignorance. For thine is the sanctity of thought, and the wonder, and all progress, forever and ever. Hell yeah. Now a couple of articles about Barack Obama's choice of a running mate. This first one is by Alexander Coburn. It was published earlier this week at counterpunch.org, and he titled it, Change? Hope? Why they must be talking about Joe Biden. Change and hope are not words that one associates with Senator Joseph Biden, a man ripely symbolic of everything that is unchanging and hopeless about our political system. The first duty of any senator from Delaware is to do the bidding of the banks and large corporations that use the tiny state as a drop box and legal sanctuary. Biden has never failed his masters in that primary task. Find any bill that sticks it to the ordinary folk on behalf of the money power, and you'll likely detect Biden's hand at work. The Bankruptcy Act of 2005 was just one example. In concert with his fellow corporate serf, Senator Tom Carper, Biden blocked all efforts to hinder bankrupt corporations from fleeing from their real locations to the legal sanctuary of Delaware. Since Obama is himself a corporate serf and from day one in the U.S. Senate has been attentive to the same masters that employ Biden, the ticket is well balanced, the seesaw with Obama at one end and Biden at the other, dead level on the fulcrum of corporate capital. Another shining moment in Biden's progress in the current presidential term was his conduct in the hearings on Judge Alito's nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court. From the opening moments of the Judiciary Committee's sessions in January of 2006, it became clear that Alito faced no serious opposition. On that first ludicrous morning, Senator Patrick Leahy sank his head into his hands, shaking it in unbelieving despair as Biden blathered out a self-serving, inane monologue that lasted a full 20 minutes before he even asked Alito one question. In his allotted half hour, Biden managed to pose only 5 questions, all of them ineptly phrased. He did pose 2 questions about Alito's membership of a racist society at Princeton, but had already undercut them in his monologue by calling Alito a man of integrity, not once, but twice, and further trivialized the interrogation by reaching under the dais to pull out a Princeton cap and put it on. In all, Biden rambled on for 4,000 words, leaving Alito time only to put together less than 1,000. A Delaware newspaper made deadly fun of him for his awful performance, eliciting the revealing confession from Biden that, quote, "I made a mistake. I should have gone straight to my question. I was trying to put him at ease," close quote. Biden is a notorious flapjaw. His vanity deludes him into believing that every word that drops from his mouth is minted in the golden currency of Pericles. Vanity is the most conspicuous characteristic of U.S. senators en bloc, nourished by deferential acolytes and often expressed in loutish sexual advances to staffers, interns, and the like. On more than one occasion, Counterpunch's editors have listened to vivid accounts by the recipient of just such advances. This staffer of another senator being accosted by Biden in the well of the Senate in the week immediately following his first wife's fatal car accident. His experience in foreign affairs consists in absolute fidelity to the conventions of Cold War liberalism, the efficient elder brother of raffish neoconservatism. Here again, the ticket is well balanced, since Senator Obama has, within a very brief time frame, exhibited great fidelity to the same creed. Obama opposed the launching of the U.S. attack on Iraq in 2003. He was not yet in the U.S. Senate, but having arrived there in 2005, he has since voted unhesitatingly for all appropriations of the vast sums required for the war's prosecution. Biden himself voted enthusiastically for the attack, declaring in the Senate debate in October 2002 in a speech excavated and sent to us by Sam Husseini, "I do not believe that this is a rush to war. I believe it is a march to peace and security. I believe that failure to overwhelmingly support this resolution is likely to enhance the prospects that war will occur. Saddam Hussein possesses chemical and biological weapons and is seeking nuclear weapons. For 4 years now, he has prevented United Nations inspectors from uncovering those weapons. The terms of surrender dictated by the United Nations require him to declare and destroy his weapons of mass destruction programs. He has not done so. Many predicted the administration would refuse to give the weapons inspectors one last chance to disarm. Mr. President, President Bush did not lash out precipitously after 9/11. He did not snub the UN or our allies. He did not dismiss a new inspection regime. He did not ignore the Congress. At each pivotal moment, he has chosen a course of moderation and deliberation. For two decades, Saddam Hussein has relentlessly pursued weapons of mass destruction. There is a broad agreement that he retains chemical and biological weapons, the means to manufacture those weapons and modified Scud missiles, and that he is actively seeking a nuclear capability. We must be clear with the American people that we are committing to Iraq for the long haul, not just the day after, but the decade after. I am absolutely confident that the president will not take us to war alone. I am absolutely confident we will enhance his ability to get the world to be with us by voting for this resolution. In step with his futile bid for the Democratic nomination, Biden changed his mind on the war, and part of his mandate will be to shore up the credentials of the Democratic ticket as being composed of responsible helmsmen of empire, stressing that any diminution of the U.S. presence in Iraq will be measured, and thus extremely slow, balanced by all the usual imperial ventures elsewhere around the globe. Why did Obama choose Biden? One important constituency that is pressing for Biden was no doubt the Israel lobby inside the Democratic Party. Obama, no matter how fervent his proclamations of support for Israel, has always been viewed with some suspicion by the lobby. For half the lifespan of the State of Israel, Biden has proved himself its unswerving acolyte in the Senate. And Obama picked Biden for the same reason Michael Dukakis chose Senator Lloyd Benson in 1988. The marriage of youth and experience. So reassuring to uncertain voters, but most of all to the elites, that nothing dangerous or unusual will discommode business as usual. Another parallel would be Kennedy's pick of Lyndon Johnson in 1960, LBJ being a political rival and a seasoned senator. Kennedy and Johnson didn't like each other, and surely after Biden's racist remarks about clean blacks, Obama cannot greatly care for Biden. It seems he would have preferred Chris Dodd, but the latter was disqualified because of his VIP loans from Countrywide. And once again, that was Alexander Coburn writing at counterpunch.org. Well, while we're on the subject of the senator from Delaware, here's a shorter article that appeared in The Nation by Robert Dreyfus. It's called, On Iraq, Biden is Worse Than McCain. Barack Obama may be doing the one thing that might have seemed impossible. He picked a running mate whose ideas about Iraq are even worse and more stupid than John McCain's. Obama, whose mushy Iraq plan excites no one, is marrying his own flawed ideas, which mostly revolve around beefing up U.S. forces in Afghanistan and unilaterally attacking Pakistan, with Biden's discredited notion of partitioning Iraq into three squabbling mini-states. Indeed, last year it was the passage by the U.S. Senate of a resolution in favor of Biden's dangerously misguided ideas that sparked an outburst of Iraqi nationalism. More than the Blackwater killings, more than the U.S. efforts to forcibly privatize Iraq's oil, it was the Biden idea of splitting Iraq into three pieces that galvanized Iraqi Arab nationalists. It does, of course, excite the Kurds to no end. Perversely, by selecting Biden, Obama may in fact hasten the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq, if only because Iraqis won't be able to stomach Vice President Biden's pompously lecturing them on why Sunnis, Shiites, and Kurds can't live together. As the always astute Raidar Visser points out, again, I gotta say I'm guessing at the pronunciation, Biden has quietly suppressed talk of his partition plan even on his own website to clean up his act in preparation for being named as Obama's running mate. Noting that Obama himself seems unable to think of Iraq in other than Sunni versus Shiite paradigm, Visser points out, arguably, the addition of Biden to the Obama ticket might aggravate these tendencies, because in the past, Biden has been a leading American voice in promoting an interpretation of Iraq as a country of three mutually hostile and internally stable population blocks. His various plans for Iraq, while frequently misunderstood in different ways, reinforce the view that the main problem in Iraq has to do with a centralized state structure and coexistence issues. Like many others in American politics, Biden has failed to acknowledge the emerging non-sectarian trends in Iraq, seeking instead to push ideas about Sunni federalism during his visit to the Anbar governorate. Need we point out that in addition, Biden joined McCain in voting for the war resolution in 2002 that propelled the U.S. into Iraq? How exactly does Obama enhance his anti-war stance by selecting a pro-war hawk as his running mate? Among other things, Obama makes it impossible for himself to criticize McCain's pre-2003 Iraq bloodlust by selecting a bloodthirsty Democrat as his running mate. Okay, it's 13 minutes after 6. You're listening to Naked Lunch Radio on WHUS. I'm Dean Farrell. This next article comes from the blog StupidEvilBastard.com, and I think really falls under the category of, you gotta be effing kidding me. Man ejected from Yankee Stadium because he left his seat during God Bless America. During the patriotic seventh-inning stretch at Yankee Stadium, nature called on Bradford Campeau-Lorient. When he tried to leave his seat during the traditional singing of God Bless America, however, he says he was stopped by an NYPD officer who said he'd have to wait until the song was done. Campeau-Lorient told WCBS-TV, I then said to him, I don't care about God Bless America, I just need to use the bathroom. And as soon as I said that, he immediately pinned my arm behind my back. The 29-year-old says two officers pinned both of his arms behind his back and ejected him from the stadium. Quote, he shoved me out the front gate and told me to get out of their country if I didn't like it. Close quote. Apparently, the New York Yankees have some sort of rule mandating that fans are not allowed to leave their seats during the playing of God Bless America. And it's enforced by the ushers, stadium security, and the NYPD. Needless to say, this is absolutely ridiculous, and the fan has contacted the local ACLU to look into a lawsuit. Meanwhile, the Yankees are saying this is a police matter. And what is the response of the cops? They've opted to lie about it. Quote, the officers observed a male standing on his seat, cursing, using inappropriate language, and acting in a disorderly manner while reeking of alcohol, and decided to eject him rather than subject others to his offensive behavior. Close quote. Campo Lorian was at the game with a Yankees season ticket holder who couldn't believe the cops' allegations. The fan who asked not to be identified said, "That's ridiculous. It's completely false." I believe, folks, it was Sinclair Lewis who said, "When fascism comes to America, it'll be wrapped in the flag and carrying the cross." Anyway, right now on Naked Lunch Radio, I think we're going to take a break for a piece of music that I happen to think is a hell of a lot better than God Bless America. See if you agree. Charles here on Naked Lunch Radio and his take on America the Beautiful, which, like I said, strikes me as a hell of a lot better than God Bless America. Whatever the case, it's 19 after 6. I'm Dean Farrell, and you're listening to Naked Lunch Radio on WHUS. This next article comes from ScienceDaily.com, or as I suppose as the religious right calls it, that satanic rag. New evidence debunks stupid Neanderthal myth. Research by UK and American scientists has struck another blow to the theory that Neanderthals became extinct because they were less intelligent than our ancestors. The research team has shown that early stone tool technologies developed by our species, Homo sapiens, were no more efficient than those used by Neanderthals. Published in the Journal of Human Evolution, their discovery debunks a textbook belief held by archaeologists for more than 60 years. The team, from the University of Exeter, Southern Methodist University, Texas State University, and the Think Computer Corporation, spent 3 years flintknapping, producing stone tools. They recreated stone tools known as flakes, which were wider tools originally used by both Neanderthals and Homo sapiens, and blades, a narrower stone tool later adopted by Homo sapiens. Archaeologists often use the development of stone blades and their assured efficiency as proof of Homo sapiens' superior intellect. To test this, the team analyzed the data to compare the number of tools produced, how much cutting edge was created, the efficiency in consuming raw material, and how long tools lasted. Blades were first produced by Homo sapiens during their colonization of Europe from Africa, approximately 40,000 years ago. This has traditionally been thought to be a dramatic technological advance, helping Homo sapiens outcompete and eventually eradicate their Stone Age cousins. Yet, when the research team analyzed their data, there was no statistical difference between the efficiency of the two technologies. In fact, their findings showed that in some respects, the flakes favored by Neanderthals were more efficient than the blades adopted by Homo sapiens. The Neanderthals, believed to be a different species from Homo sapiens, evolved in Ice Age Europe, while the latter evolved in Africa before spreading out to the rest of the world around 50 to 40,000 years ago. Neanderthals are thought to have died out around 28,000 years ago, suggesting at least 10,000 years of overlap and possible interaction between the two species in Europe. Many long-held beliefs suggesting why the Neanderthals went extinct have been debunked in recent years. Research has already shown that Neanderthals were as good at hunting as Homo sapiens were, and had no clear disadvantage in their ability to communicate. Now, these latest findings add to the growing evidence that Neanderthals were no less intelligent than our ancestors. Martin Aaron, an MA experimental archaeology student at the University of Exeter and lead author of the paper, comments, "Our research disputes a major pillar holding up the long-held assumption that Homo sapiens were more advanced than Neanderthals. It is time for archaeologists to start researching for other reasons why Neanderthals became extinct while our ancestors survived. Technologically speaking, there is no clear advantage of one tool over the other. When we think of Neanderthals, we need to stop thinking in terms of stupid or less advanced and more in terms of different. Now that it's established that there is no technical advantage to blades, why did Homo sapiens adopt this technology during their colonization of Europe? The researchers suggest that the reason for this shift may be more cultural or symbolic. Aaron explains, colonizing a continent isn't easy. Colonizing a continent during the Ice Age is even harder. So, for early Homo sapiens colonizing Ice Age Europe, a newly shared and flashy-looking technology might serve as one form of social glue by which larger social networks were bonded. Thus, during hard times and resource droughts, these larger social networks might act like a type of life insurance, ensuring exchange and trade among members on the same team. The University of Exeter is the only university in the world to offer a degree course in experimental archaeology. This strand of archaeology focuses on understanding how people lived in the past by recreating their activities and replicating their technologies. Aaron says, "It was only by spending 3 years in the lab learning how to physically make these tools that we were able to finally replicate them accurately enough to come up with our findings." This research was funded by the National Science Foundation of the United States and the Exeter Graduation Fund. Wanted to remind you once again, folks, that podcasts of Naked Lunch Radio are now available. You can get them from the AInfos Radio Project by going to radioforall.net. That's radio4all.net. Either that or it's org, but it's definitely radio4all.net. Something. Just type Naked Lunch Radio into their on-site search engine and you'll get to the page with the podcast available. All right, now we're going to move on to what I've long called one of my favorite websites, blackagendareport.com. Hey, I told you folks, I have a cold this week. My brain's not functioning at its regular capacity. Anyway, this is written by Bruce Dixon and it's titled FCC Announces 80 City We're Not Listening Digital TV Tour. Now, there's a headline that would make The Onion proud. Anyway, here's what Bruce Dixon had to say. Okay, almost all of us know about the transition to digital TV. All that most of us know about the transition to digital TV is two things. The first is that some people will need converter boxes on their old TVs to receive the new digital broadcasts. The second is that digital broadcast technology will enable high-definition TV. As far as corporate broadcasters and the FCC are concerned, that's all we need to know. And those are the boundaries of legitimate public discourse. What the FCC and broadcasters are actively concealing from the public is that digital broadcasting technology enables thousands of new digital TV channels on the public broadcast spectrum, all of which broadcasters have allocated to themselves without the inconvenient public scrutiny that issuing thousands of new station licenses might have attracted. Thus, minorities and women, local entrepreneurs, colleges and universities, community, civic, and labor organizations, and local governments, who otherwise might acquire a portion of the new digital TV channels and use them to broadcast local news, art, information, and public service in hundreds of U.S. markets, have been frozen out of the chance to serve the public over the public's airwaves without even the bother of public explanation or debate. Utterly captured by the private broadcasters it is supposed to police and regulate, the FCC has been tasked with selling this piece of Grand Theft Digital as a public service and farmed out the job to the notorious public relations firm of Ketchum Communications. According to PR Watch, Ketchum Communications are past masters of corporate disinformation, responsible for a string of suspect activities, including drafting tobacco ads for tobacco firms, denying the links between smoking and disease, and promoting the myth that low-tar cigarettes are somehow less deadly, coordinating PR for the Cool Jazz Festival intended to pretty up the name of Big Tobacco, running fake business-funded science organizations touting the safety of pesticides, hormones, and food additives, spying on, smearing, and facilitating the firing of pro-environmental FDA scientists, recommending as early as the 90s the labeling of environmentalists as terrorists, and the suing of investigative journalists, and conducting a 30-city PR blitz against an EPA report on the health effects of dioxin, one of the most toxic chemicals ever made. Covertly hiring TV host and syndicated columnist Armstrong Williams to discredit public education and shill for the No Child Left Behind Act, and manufacturing dozens of fake video news releases that were distributed to hundreds of TV stations where they were broadcast as news. Predictably, excuse me, folks, Ketchum's elaborate public education campaign on digital TV makes no mention of any obligations that broadcasters might have to serve the public over publicly owned spectrum. It is calculated to confine public input on the DTV transition to those things the public must do in order to passively consume whatever commercial broadcasters decide to give them. As part of this campaign, the FCC has announced plans to send staffers and commissioners to 80 cities across the country in what looks suspiciously like a We're Not Listening tour between now and February 18, 2009. With few exceptions, FCC staffers and commissioners will be totally unprepared to explain their complicity in handing over the digital airwaves to commercial broadcasters, who not only don't have programming for the new channels, but who will probably squat on the new frequencies until some profitable use appears. For the most part, the FCC won't be entertaining questions about why broadcasters are not obligated to broadcast news, local public service, or other local content on the new channels, or why consumers ought to prize high-definition TV over high-quality content. The FCC will be talking, but it won't be listening. Back in 2003, the FCC's okay of unlimited consolidation of print and broadcast media inspired a wave of public revulsion that almost nobody predicted and almost nobody in the mainstream print and broadcast media reported. Nonetheless, it resulted in millions of letters and emails to the FCC, millions more signatures on petitions to Congress, and subsequent intervention by the courts and Congress nullifying the FCC's decree. It also resulted, to hear some tell it, in the formation of a self-aware movement for media justice in cities and towns around the country. If such a movement really exists, this may be its defining moment. If there is indeed a movement for media justice, when the FCC commissioners and corporate PR flacks from Ketchum and the NAB fan out on their not-listening tour to 80 cities between September and February, aiming to misdirect public attention on the digital TV question, citizens and communities will give them an earful, whether they're ready to hear it or not. Just as in 2003, the FCC decision and congressional legislation to privatize the entire digital TV spectrum are a train already on the tracks and in motion. Only a vast public outcry can derail them. A new Congress and a new administration, in and of themselves, are absolutely no guarantee that the transformation of public digital broadcast spectrum into the unregulated private property of existing broadcasters, who have failed the test of localism and public service every day for decades, will not be consummated in February of 2009. While Republican and Democratic presidential candidates are both well aware of the issues involved in the digital transition, neither seems willing to question this theft of public property. Barack Obama's chief advisor on telecom affairs, a black attorney who so far has raised at least $500,000 for the Obama campaign, presumably from broadcasters and their lawyers, is William Kennard. As the FCC's general counsel from 1993 to 96 and its chairman from 96 to 01, Kennard is arguably one of the fathers of this monstrously crooked deal, not to mention the disastrous Telecommunications Act of 1996. Upon leaving government at the beginning of the Bush administration, Kennard became the managing director of media buyout operations for the bipartisan Carlyle Group. With the Bush administration having moved the ball downfield for broadcasters these last 8 years, commercial broadcasters confidently expect their interest to prevail over the public's, no matter who runs Congress or the White House. If Ketchum Communications, the FCC, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the mainstream media can confine the story and restrict the public conversation to converter boxes and high-definition TV, then a vast realm of public digital property will pass into unaccountable private hands, for nothing, and maybe forever. But if citizens come out, speak out, and act out in the presence of both each other and the FCC's corporate flacks, then maybe, just maybe, the Congress, the courts, the FCC, and a new administration will have to listen, whether they want to or not. And again, that was Bruce Dixon writing at blackagendareport.com. The piece was titled, FCC Announces 80 City We're Not Listening Digital TV Tour. It's 6:32, and we're about halfway through this week's Naked Lunch Radio with yours truly, Dean Farrell, right here at WHUS 91.7 FM. For the next 5 minutes, we're going to check out the folks at freepress.net doing this week's edition of Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. Millions of people listen to internet radio every day. One of the most successful webcasters, Pandora, has about 1 million listeners daily and is one of the 10 most popular applications for Apple's iPhone. Yet Pandora and many other webcasters are close to shutting down their operations because they can't keep up with the royalties they must pay to performers and record companies. Last year, the Copyright Royalty Board, a federal panel of 3 permanent judges, ordered that webcasters more than double their payments per song. For Pandora, a site that lets customers create their own stations and listen for free, royalty fees will amount to 70% of its projected revenue. Webcasters have strongly objected to the hike, saying the CRB unfairly singled out internet radio for the increase. Webcasters must pay 2 sets of copyright owners, the owners of the musical works, usually the songwriter or composer, and the owners of the sound recordings themselves, a record label or the recording artist. Traditional radio stations pay a flat per-song fee and are only responsible for royalties on the musical work. The Internet Radio Equality Act, proposed in Congress to nullify the hikes and modify the fees, gathered more than 100 co-sponsors, but has stagnated in committee. Since the CRB ruling, deals have been cut between Sound Exchange, the organization that represents artists and record companies, and satellite and cable radio. The negotiations have cut their royalty rates to less than half of what webcasters pay, but independent webcasters like Pandora haven't been let in on the deal. Last week, Representative Howard Berman from California entered the fray. He's trying to mediate a deal between the webcasters and Sound Exchange, but the two sides remain far apart. For more information, go to savenetradio.org.
This month, the courts have ruled on some important issues involving copyright. A New York court refused to stop the distribution of the film Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed. EMI Records and Capitol Records had alleged that the filmmakers violated copyrights of John Lennon's Imagine when they used a 15-second clip of the song while showing images about religion and science. The court decision established for the first time that fair use applies to copyrights in sound recordings. Sherwin C., staff attorney for Public Knowledge, explains the term fair use.
There's certain uses that aren't infringement. If a use of a work meets certain criteria, it's not an infringement of copyright. You want to be able to quote things. You want to be able to critique things. You want to be able to use copyrighted materials in education or in news reporting. These things shouldn't be considered copyright infringements because they're important parts of public discourse. So these would be fair uses.
In another case, a federal appeals court ruled that Cablevision's remote DVRs, which work like off-site TiVos to record television programs, didn't infringe copyright. The court ruled that there was no significant legal difference between the remote DVR and a VCR or a TiVo.
Basically, it's functionally identical to a TiVo. Just the way in which it's built is different.
The Supreme Court has previously ruled on Betamax and VCR technology and affirmed that it's okay to have a device that records programs off the air.
The fact that anytime the technology changes, you get more lawsuits, that's a problem. These lawsuits will keep new services from coming out, keep consumers from being able to use them.
It's much more important than simple convenience or having a new gizmo to play with, says C. Being able to use material allows us to participate in cultural and political conversations.
The ability to record things and to take in that media and to remix it, to play with it, to excerpt it. If I find somebody saying something that I think is horribly wrong or offensive or bizarre on TV, and I want to show how offensive or strange or wrong that is on my blog, I can record that, transfer it to my computer, I can post it on my blog, and then start talking about it. If I just want to critique something or comment on it, I can do that. Being able to do that and show literally what it is that I'm talking about is a powerful tool. It's a powerful tool politically. It's a powerful tool culturally. We shouldn't lock people out of being able to do that just because technology has evolved and just because it's changed.
For more information, go to publicknowledge.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
And just a reminder, gang, you can catch Media Minutes every week on Naked Lunch Radio at approximately 6:30. All right, we got about 23 minutes left to go, and I'd like to stay on media for one more article. This comes from the UK Guardian. The author's name is Kieran McCarthy, and the piece is titled, Why TV News in the US is Utter Rubbish. For years, it has been a joke that news in the United States is terrible, obsessed with trivia and celebrity, fronted by Botox bimbos, forever interviewing citizens about some artifact of small-time life when a major news story is breaking elsewhere. The truth is that it's far, far worse than that. There are a multitude of news channels, CNN, MSNBC, CBS, NBC, PBS, Fox. But after an hour of flipping between them during lunchtime last week, this was the sum total of the information I gleaned. There are two U.S. presidential candidates. They have produced campaign ads. People have made video parodies and posted them to the internet. A U.S. TV news host appeared on a U.S. TV chat show last night, and someone said something controversial, read ignorant, on a different TV show the day before. In the meantime, one of the most sought-after war criminals in the world was arrested and sent for trial. Several new scientific breakthroughs had been announced. Zimbabwe edged carefully towards shared government. The Indian government dealt with votes of no confidence in terrorist attacks, and countless other real stories came and went. For millions of Americans, these events appeared as 15-word ticker tapes at the bottom of their TV screens. It's not the absolute dearth of real news that's the problem, however. It's that the news that is presented is not news, but mindless, misleading gossip. The clearest example of this is when one of the commentators on any given story provides their quote-unquote analysis. That consists of showing a video clip and then talking with the assumed voice of the person in the clip. So, for example, Barack Obama gave a press conference. A clip of around 4 or 5 seconds of what he said is shown, and then the people in the TV studio take over. News anchor. So what he's saying is, hey, I'm the guy in charge here. I'm the person who decides what to do, not you. Is that right? Commentator. I think what he was saying was, if I become president, then I'll be the person who calls the shots. Commentator 2. I don't agree. He's saying, I'm going to listen to others. That's what I'll do. But make no mistake, I'll be the person who makes the final decision. This goes on and on, with people making up dialogue and pretending to be Obama or John McCain or anyone else who comes to mind, rather than broadcasting what was actually said. But it gets worse. Unfair comment. The analysis of what someone has said is clearly bent by the reporters themselves along ideological lines. Unrelated facts and events are attached and then attacked, and the original news point ends up as little more than a launching pad for the expert's own political perspectives. So a sober report on, say, housing prices ends up as a criticism of the Republican Party's fiscal policy, without any details of that policy being provided. In the worst cases, something with no news value at all is introduced in order to score political points, such as McCain eating at a German restaurant or Obama knocking fists with his wife. Tail chasing and navel gazing. The media report constantly on themselves. Anything reported on the TV news instantly becomes something to be reported on. For an entire day, the lead on most TV networks was whether the media was giving Obama too much coverage. The second day comprised whether the coverage given to Obama was too uncritical. By the third day, much of the coverage was about the previous 2 days' coverage, complete with clips of how rival networks were covering the so-called news. News hosts also regularly appear on other news host shows and then feature that appearance on their own show. Never let the story get in the way. The focus is entirely on the backstory, and the actual news is given lip service. So you'll hear more about how a decision was arrived at than what the actual decision was or what impact it might have. The idea is that you're getting the real juice. The reality is that you're forced to drink a pint of conjecture concentrate. Presidential campaign ads have become lead stories. A one-second image flash of Britney Spears and Paris Hilton in a recent ad implied that Obama was no more than a celebrity. It led to hours of primetime news speculation, while the ad's central claim that Obama would raise taxes if elected was ignored. The Jerry Springer School of Journalism. There's never a neutral statement. It is always an extreme perspective. If you're the news anchor, you can speak in a third-party voice and add a question mark on the end to suggest impartiality. But otherwise, wild claims are balanced with an equally wild claim at the other end. If someone attempts to point out logical inconsistencies, they are almost always faced with personal mockery by other commentators. Here's but one example of this schoolyard bully behavior. When one commentator speaking from Las Vegas tried to point out why an offshore drilling bill, which had been misrepresented as a reason why the Democrats were responsible for high petrol prices, had not been passed by Congress, he was told by the anchor that he had clearly spent too much time at the craps tables. He was soon told after by another commentator that he had spent too much time at the bar. The substance of his argument did not merit discussion. The goldfish rush. There is no effort to provide historical context. The news is paced so frenetically that anything beyond sound bites is not tolerated. News anchors consistently talk over the top of anyone who doesn't provide a punchy point every 10 seconds. Swooshing graphics and dance music add to the general level of pace, which effectively masks the fact that almost nothing is being provided beyond personal opinion. When did you stop beating your wife? Coverage is deeply cynical in the sense that people are assumed to have a hidden and planned agenda, even when the connection drawn would have been impossible to predict as it doesn't follow logical reasoning. Speculation with no foundation in logic or fact is opened up as a serious news item with the simple inclusion of the phrase, did insert name of person know about insert event? The answer, if there was ever any attempt to actually arrive at it, will almost always be no. Fight, fight, fight. There is no effort to reach a greater understanding. Instead, the sole intent is to provoke disagreement and partisan perspective, with the anchor used solely to egg on disagreement. Nearly every segment ends with the anchor shutting off argument and promoting the idea that they simply will have to agree to disagree. So, where do you get your news while living in the United States? News-starved Americans usually hold up NPR, National Public Radio, as the best option. But with interlude music fresh from the 1920s and a twee kitchen table chat approach, this is news wrapped in a tea cozy. Two comedy programs, The Daily Show and The Colbert Report, fill a peculiar niche of serious analysis with gags and are possibly the main news source for people under 30. They both viciously lampoon the news media, which pretend not to notice and run clips from them on their own shows. There is hope, however. The non-news cycle is increasingly being broken by the internet. Thanks to cheap digital technology and fast net connections, online video is a simple prospect and means it's possible to get your fix of moving images with real news thrown in. Not that TV news is concerned. The internet, and YouTube in particular, is a network's dream. An Aladdin's cave of uninformed, one-sided, and aggressive gossip and commentary, all of it searchable and requiring minimal expenditure of time or money. So every day, you can find news anchors running short clips of the very best the internet can offer before turning to the experts to give their views. And once again, that was Kieran McCarthy writing recently in the UK Guardian, Why TV News is Utter Rubbish. All right, we got about 15 more minutes of Naked Lunch Radio still to come here on WHUS. This next one is by Frank Silva from opednews.com, and it's titled, Shut Your Pie Hole. Americans are taught to believe in Mickey Mouse, Disneyland, and by extension, that America is the happiest place on Earth. We're Americans. We're the best. We rescued Europe twice and even included those snobby French people. We should have let the Nazis occupy them a little longer. That would have taught them a lesson. Our history is spotless. There's no need to doubt our righteousness. We took lands from inferior savages, and in exchange, we gave them whiskey and Jesus. Mexico attacked us, so we took Texas as punishment. I think they wanted us to have it. The Mexicans knew even then that the people there were loco. We freed Cuba, then let organized crime have it. We occupied the Philippines because Teddy Roosevelt said our little brown brothers couldn't govern themselves. We deposed countless tyrants and communists in countless countries, most to this day that still do not understand the good we've done for them and that still harbor ill will toward us. Ingrates. During World War II, God blessed us with developing the biggest atomic bomb known to science, the biggest bomb known to science before anyone else. And by some accounts, Hitler was only about 3 months away from one of his own. God also granted us the power to use weapons of mass destruction. Only a country like ours with obvious good intentions is justified in using them, even on cities with non-combatants and no military targets, because vengeance is ours, saith the president. If God is for us, who could be against us? After World War II, America was off and running on the fast track to good times and world domination. And after the demise of the godless Soviet Union, America was the undisputed heavyweight champion of the world. But instead of advocating peace and benevolence, those in control of America opted for naked aggression and total dominance abroad, and, since 9/11, at home, too. Naked aggression doesn't work, though. The British Empire found that out. Their lesson, of course, came at the hands of unpatriotic dissidents that hated the unfair policies of their country so much that they declared independence from it. Insolent bastards. Lucky for them, they're dead today, or none of them would be able to fly anywhere, or they'd all be in Gitmo where they belong. Where do people like them get off thinking they can criticize political leaders or their government? Fortunately for those in power, Americans are no longer revolutionary. Americans are patriots. They wave the flag whenever they're told to. They believe whatever they're told, because not believing equals treason. Most Americans have lost the true meaning of freedom because they've so easily accepted the illusion repeated ad nauseam that we are unquestioningly free. Why? Because unpatriotic American corporations have taken over our democracy. Independent and impartial journalism has been replaced by people charged with forming public opinion to benefit the corporations and the small group of people that own them all. We're stuck with an educational system that purposely lacks substance and leads students away from independent critical thinking. Subjects such as history, foreign languages, and cultural studies are discouraged, except for Americanized versions of history, and cursory introductions to foreign languages and cultures that focus on their obvious inferiorities. And let's not even mention depressing philosophical subjects like ethics. To simplify things even further for Americans, our two-party politics has melded into two sides of one party, controlled by the same obscene wealth that controls everything else we see, hear, smell, taste, and touch. And what a spectacular show they put on for the peons in pretending to be two distinct parties, both with values, ethics, and morals that claim to represent the working class and vehemently oppose each other as part of a functioning democratic process. Put that together with the great American science of propaganda that not only won every war in American history up until Vietnam, but expertly succeeds in distracting the public from delving too deeply into issues that may take unnecessary time away from their various part-time jobs or shopping. Wrap it all up in a flag and tie it with a big red, white, and blue bow, and you have a system that HBO couldn't create with a team of writers that included Orwell, Huxley, Twain, and Shakespeare. The fact is, America has run out of time. There's very little hope left for our nation. It's all too depressing. I'll admit that I'm saturated by national and world affairs. It's so wearing on me that I'm even getting tired of trying to inform people, enlighten them, inspire them, or make them laugh. I've almost stopped trying to make them angry or push their buttons so that they wake up, even if it's just to argue with me, because open discussion and debate are cornerstones of democracy. If I could, I'd smoke pot, but that's not allowed either. Just say no to drugs. No problem getting antidepressants prescribed by a doctor and supplied by great American pharmaceutical companies, though. Except I have no health care and can't afford them, and my VA retirement benefits don't kick in until I reach 60. But the good news is that I hear the VA is handing out antidepressants like M&Ms. If the U.S. still exists when I'm 60, I can probably get Prozac by the truckload. And price is no object. Thanks, taxpayers! Until then, I'm kind of stuck, just like the rest of America's critical thinkers. I feel defeated. I mourn the death of my country. However, I still feel compelled to write. I'm not sure why. At this point, I think it's more for therapy and as a way to prevent my own spontaneous combustion. Just for the hell of it, let me ask this. If our government were a car that had been in a bad accident and was hit on all sides, how would we treat it? Do we take it apart and replace almost every piece, or do we total it and replace it with a new one? We keep going back and forth from Democrats to Republicans and replacing smashed fenders with smashed fenders that were banged out and repainted. Let's just total the damn thing already and get a new car. I caught part of an old movie on cable some time ago, never got the name of it. The tyrant in the film, who I think was Basil Rathbone, was stopped by the hero from doing something nefarious to the people. He then ridiculed the hero about what would happen next, knowing the system would go on. Rathbone's great line was, "Shepherds change, but sheep remain sheep." When a president can deny habeas corpus and due process to citizens, violate the Constitution, start illegal wars, commit war crimes, and void impeachment for just causes, assume dictatorial powers and issue signing statements of the types and in the numbers that this sitting president has with impunity and without inciting protests, much less riots, in every major American city, the game is over, my friends. And what's worse is, the bastards know that those of us who study history and know the issues know the game is over, too. That's why they let people like Sean Penn, Susan Sarandon, or Michael Moore speak out. We're free to say almost anything. We're just not able to do anything about changing things or solving problems. Besides that, the right-wing spin machine will discredit their words anyway, as well as the words of anyone critical of the power structure. And allowing some people, especially famous ones, to say things in a defined and controlled manner plays into the game that perpetuates the fallacy that we have a free and open society. Let Sean Penn get a following of people committed to action and see what happens to him. Frank Silva is a SAG-AFTRA actor, writer, former social studies teacher, and retired Army Reserve officer. He specializes in comedy and satire and has two political social commentary books, too controversial and incendiary to be published in a free and open society. He welcomes dialogue and debate, which he considers the lifeblood of democracy, but urges weak-kneed Democrats, conservative right-wing Republican knotheads, and delusional religious hypocrites to come prepared with facts, not fantasies obtained from so-called liberal mainstream American media.
Rise up, rise up, rise up. They say
blades to protect you while they try to dispossess you of the right to decide between wrong or right, to openly discuss what politicians hide. They want to keep their secret plans from the public eye. We gotta keep our fire burning, keep our spirits bright. We gotta rise up, rise up, rise up. Rise up, people, against the war. Rise up, people, against the war. Rise up, people, against the war. Rise up, people. Money got no children, and bombs ain't for building. Killing ain't no way to make a peaceful day, as all of God's children can easily explain. We gotta keep our fires burning, keep our spirits bright. Stand up and speak for what we know is right. We gotta rise up, rise up, rise up. Rise up, people, against the war. Rise up, people, against the war. Rise up, people, against the war. Rise up, people. I see days ahead. I kiss my children into bed. All across the planet I see that everything is fine.
Yeah.
Rise up, people. Against the war, rise up, people, against the war, rise up, people, against the war, rise up, people. We got the power and the will, and we'll do it for our children. For the warmongers and the corporate whores in the history books with the dinosaurs. I claim my power, I claim my rights. No dirty tricks are gonna change my mind. I'm gonna rise up, rise up, rise up. I'm gonna rise up, rise up, rise up. Rise up, people, against the war. 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 Rise
And that, my friends, will do it for another hour of Primal Scream Therapy that I like to call Naked Lunch Radio. Oh, that last piece of music, by the way, was David Fryer doing Rise Up, People. This is Dean Farrell, and I just wanted to remind you that any opinions you may hear on this show, whether I express them in my own capacity or in the capacity of the writers I'm reading, do not necessarily reflect the views of the staff, management, licensee, or somebody else I usually mention but can't remember now, WHUS. Sorry, folks, I have a cold this week. My brain's a little woozy. Anyway, if you'd like to touch base with me, your best bet would be to drop me an email. My address is nakedlunchradio@hotmail.com. Coming up next, it'll be Ken with 2 hours of In the Groove, Jazz, and Beyond. This is Dean Farrell inviting you to tune in next Saturday at 6 for more Naked Lunch Radio, right here at 91.7 FM, WHUS, Storrs, Connecticut.